It's Tuesday. It's September. It's still your favourite European podcast that doesn't talk about Brexit. Play the jingle. We're back. Dominic Kramer, how are you doing?
I'm fine. I've had a lot of holiday, so I'm doing very well. You've also had quite a lot, I believe.
Yeah, loads. I've just come back from Spain, from Bilbao, where I've been eating my weight in pinchos, which is basically like really ambitious tapas.
And you suggested on one of our social media accounts that you'd be up for moving there.
Yeah, it's super nice. It's just really chilled and the food's really good and the wine's really good and it's sunny. I'd quite happily decamp.
I do feel like you say that about almost everywhere you go.
I think I've just become a Parisian in that I like everywhere else more, like to complain about my town. But no, Paris is home these days. It's nice too. I'm very lucky.
Also, maybe everyone seems like incredibly friendly wherever you go compared to Parisians.
Although Parisians are being really nice at the moment because this is the time of year that's known as la rentrée, like the return from the summer holidays. Everyone's just come back from their really, really long August break. So they're in like a really weirdly good mood. And you just spend a lot of time in the office, like kissing people and talking about how tan they are. It's nice.
Oh, wow. It's not what I expected from a newsroom.
It happens for just like a week and then everyone's really miserable again. But what have I missed on your end? How have you been?
I've been fine. I didn't really actually have much to report because I've been relaxing and working very hard with you on plans for special episodes that will be hitting your podcast machines before too long.
Woo.
But it does feel like particularly absurd this week that we are making a podcast about Europe in which we don't mention the B word after all that's been happening in the UK Parliament. It feels like it got even weirder than it was before the summer in the UK.
It did. And I feel like being on holiday gave us more time to follow it than we would normally have, which is probably not that great for our sanity.
Definitely not. I've actually taken to like watching the parliamentary debates from bed on my phone.
Dominic.
I then can't get to sleep, obviously.
Obviously.
But I think essentially we are right to keep this a safe space without any mention of the B word or the B person. Can we refer to him as that?
B person. Now I'm imagining him dressed up as a bee, which is weird because he's quite round and it looks quite good actually. But I think we should because actually plenty has been happening on the rest of the continent now. So it's a good time to turn our gaze resolutely away from the calamity that is British politics and look at the rest of the continent. Stuff has been happening. What are we talking about this week?
Well, we're going to direct our gaze specifically at the east of Germany and one town in particular, Görlitz. We're going to be speaking to Emily Schultheis, a writer and fellow of the Institute for Current World Affairs based in Germany, who recently spent a month in Görlitz, which is the easternmost city in Saxony on the border of Poland, to try and understand why the far right have been doing so well there and why they've been doing well in the east of Germany more generally. She said she wanted to understand the enduring political, social and economic differences between the east and west of Germany, almost 30 years after the fall of the Berlin Wall. So we're going to be speaking to Emily later about all the people she met and about Görlitz. So keep listening. A nice jolly start to the season.
Yay! That is coming up after Let's do Good Week first, because we're going to Italy for Good Week, and I really need filling in, because a lot has changed since we went on holiday.
Yes, okay. Well, I was going to ask, can I do a little short preamble before I actually reveal who is getting Good Week?
Yeah, we need a bit of a recap.
Good, okay. It's very kind of you.
You're welcome.
You've become very nice since the holiday. You should have a holiday more often.
I tell you, this is the French rentrée spirit, and it's going to last exactly a week. Next week, I'm going to be mean to you all over again.
Oh, no. Anyway, a lot has happened in Italy whilst we were away. You probably saw lots of pictures of Matteo Salvini gallivanting around on the beach topless early on in the summer, basking in the summer sun and his incredibly high poll ratings at the time. That's all history now, but in brief, he attempted to take advantage of the high poll ratings of his party, the Northern League, and tried to force an election. A strategy which rather backfired as his coalition partners, the Five Star Movement, instead decided to form a coalition with PD, the Social Democrats of Italy. albeit a potentially shaky one. His poll ratings also dropped somewhat, so he may have made a bit of a mistake. Now, as we've talked about before, Salvini seemed to rather define himself by his hardline attitude to migrants, with positions that have been widely criticised as anti-humanitarian and xenophobic. Therefore, it will be a relief for many people that the new coalition is appointing Luciana Lamorgese as interior minister. Luciana, you're not only getting that job, but you're also getting Good Week from us. I'm sure that's the real prize you were after.
Congratulations.
So who is Luciana, I hear you say, Katie?
It's exactly what I'm saying.
She is a specialist in migration policy and a longtime civil servant, having worked in the Interior Ministry for 38 years. She was the first female security chief of Milan, and she seems all round pretty experienced for this job, having managed the planning for refugee and migrant arrival centres for northern Italy. There are reports that a new immigration law has been agreed as part of the coalition agreement, so observers expect a shift in direction for Italy's policy around migration. She's going to have a big job ahead of her, taking over a position which Salvini was using to espouse his anti-immigrant views very loudly, often using social media with his ranty Facebook Live videos. Lamorgese, you may be pleased to hear, does not use social media at all.
At all?
No.
Whoa.
So it's going to be quite a change. And sidebar, did you see this week that Carola Rackete has been successful in persuading the prosecutors of Rome to place Salvini under investigation for defamation from some of his ranty videos?
Oh, that's going through.
It's going through, and he might have parliamentary privilege or whatever the Italian equivalent is of that. But it's been suggested that maybe MPs could vote to withdraw that from him.
Juicy.
Keep watching. Anyway, Lamorgese took her position officially on Thursday last week, along with the other ministers in the new coalition, which includes Luigi Di Maio, who's the leader of the Five Star Movement. He's foreign minister, and Roberto Gualtieri from PD, who's the finance minister. And whilst we don't know what Luciana is going to do, I expect it will, at the very least, be much less extreme than what Salvini was doing. The coalition's decision to appoint a technocrat in this interior ministry is probably quite a savvy move to try and depoliticize immigration policy in Italy. And this is surely a step in the right direction. How big a step? We'll have to wait and see. But for now, take Good Week, Luciana. Use it well.
I have a question for you. This government seems really like normal compared to the last one. But is it like sustainable? Because this feels a bit like the bit in the film where everything's fine, except we're only 2/3 of the way through the film and like something bad is going to happen.
Yeah, who knows? I mean, people are saying it might not be sustainable, but they managed to get it together. And the Five Star Movement did this thing where they are big believers in direct democracy, and they had an online poll for all their members asking them to decide whether to support going into this coalition. And I think it was successful by 79% in favour of going into this coalition. So it has strong backing from the party members. So perhaps it's more solid than people were expecting.
I hope so. I'm not really that sad to see the back of Salvini. I'm sorry if that makes me sound terribly biased. But I kind of feel like his politics haven't necessarily disappeared. Like, his party is still really super popular. They like really dominate the right wing in Italy. So he's still lurking around.
Yeah, and there's a part of me that just thinks that the two parties in coalition will be punished by the electorate next time round for having compromised their various sides. Meanwhile, Salvini can carry on shouting on Facebook Live in a reactionary way, and it's just delaying the inevitable. But we'll see.
That was Good Week.
Good Week. Who's had a bad week, Katie?
We're going to go to Austria for Bad Week this week, to the mountains, for a story that I started out thinking was quite funny, but actually it's a bit more serious than that. And I think it says quite interesting things about how we deal with our history in Europe. So there's this fancy hotel in the Alps. It's a 4-star hotel in the village of Herlos, which, like most hotels these days, is on TripAdvisor and Booking.com, where guests can like leave reviews afterwards. And normally when hotels get bad reviews, it's because the room is a bit dirty or the walls are too thin and you can hear people doing interesting things on the other side or whatever.
Interesting things.
Interesting things. I don't know.
What an innuendo, Katie.
Vigorous activities. This hotel was very dismayed last year to get 2 reviews on TripAdvisor and Booking.com. But it wasn't about the hotel being dirty or about noise or anything like that. It was complaining that there was a photo hanging in the lobby of a man in Nazi uniform with a swastika on it and everything. Now, these reviews were left by a German guest who was quite troubled to see someone in this uniform being honoured in this way, with like a photo right there proudly displayed in the entrance. So the German guest took to TripAdvisor and Booking.com to express his feelings about it. I'll read you a little bit of the review from TripAdvisor. He said, "For us, seeing a Nazi being honoured publicly at a hotel was a huge disappointment. We felt indignation and disgust, as this made us wonder what the hotel owners are trying to tell us with this image." So the German guy left this review on TripAdvisor, another one on Booking.com, which was similar but in German, and the hotel was not very happy about this, because in parts of rural Austria, it's the custom to hang up pictures of old family members. And it turned out that this man in the uniform was an uncle, and unfortunately this particular picture of him was the only picture they had of him. And apart from that, they also made a legal argument against the guest, a quite specific legal argument, saying that what he wrote in his reviews, calling this guy in quotes a Nazi grandpa, was defamatory. Their argument was, okay, maybe this man in the photo is wearing the uniform of the Wehrmacht, which was the armed forces of Nazi Germany at the time, but they argued that that didn't necessarily make him a Nazi personally. Kind of an interesting semantic argument. I don't know. The hotel asked the two websites to take the reviews down. Booking.com did, TripAdvisor didn't. And the twist is that it's actually a bad week, not for the hotel, but for the guest, because they are suing, the hotel is suing the guest for defamation, saying that like they're kind of smearing their reputation, and also by kind of insinuating that by hanging this picture up in the lobby, that they themselves were Nazi sympathizers. So yeah, it's a really interesting one. The guest ended up doing some historical research on the family to prove his point, and it turned out that the guy in the photo and another guy hanging up next to him were actually both official members of the Nazi party. So he wasn't really that wrong on that front.
I'm going to be more careful what I write in TripAdvisor reviews in future.
What have you been writing? Are you a prolific reviewer?
No, I think I've reviewed like twice. One like where I had exceptionally good service somewhere and one place where I had exceptionally bad service. And I thought in both cases, I wanted the world to know.
I would love to read your furious review. But yeah, it's a kind of interesting case. Firstly, yes, because it turns out you can get sued for what you write on TripAdvisor. And secondly, because I don't know, I think it raises some interesting questions about like how we're supposed to deal with this part of our history within families. Like, I've got friends who've got family members who are in the Nazi party, or like, you know.
Well, I mean, everyone in Germany does.
Right.
Basically. Have friends.
And it's also not like an isolated phenomenon. Like, I've been to parts of Alsace in France where you can go to like bakeries and there's pictures of people's relatives up there in Nazi uniforms on the wall. So it's an interesting dispute. I kind of think it tests out this balance between the hotel having the freedom to do what they want and continue with their cultural customs and not offending other people. But personally, if it was my hotel and I had like lots of international customers coming, I probably wouldn't want pictures of Nazi relatives up there. Or relatives in Nazi uniforms, I should say.
It's quite bold.
It is indeed.
Shall we do an interview?
Yeah.
Where are we going, Katie?
We are going to Germany, Eastern Germany specifically. We were talking about Salvini in Italy a little bit earlier. And part of the reason that I find him so fascinating is because he has really helped to normalise these quite extreme politics, like the way he talks about migrants, the way he talks about Islam. And for the last few years, there's been a kind of similar phenomenon in Germany in the form of the rise of the AfD, the Alternative für Deutschland party. They're a far-right party, heavily anti-immigration. And they've been making strong gains since Angela Merkel's decision a few years ago to let in about 1.5 million refugees. Most recently, they've done very well over the past week in 2 state elections in eastern Germany, Saxony and Brandenburg, which is the state that surrounds Berlin. And they are now the second biggest party in each of those state parliaments. So we wanted to talk a little bit this week about that party and like why the far right has been doing well in eastern Germany in particular. And we're going to be talking about that with the help of Emily Schultheis. She is an American journalist based in Berlin and a fellow of the Institute of Current World Affairs. She also writes for The Atlantic and Foreign Policy, among other publications. And Emily spent a month living in a town right on the Polish border, very, very far east, called Görlitz, which kind of sums up in a lot of ways this kind of divide that has opened up between East and West Germany and might help to explain in some ways why the far right has started to do so well there. And Emily is on the line right now. Could you maybe start us off by giving us a kind of quick potted history of the AfD? Like, who are they? Where did they come from? How did we get here?
Sure. So the AfD was founded in 2013, and originally it was focused very much on the issue of the euro currency. So at the time, the topic of refugees and migration were not even really on the agenda for them. They ran their first election in the fall of 2013. They came just short of the 5% that they needed in order to get into the German parliament, the Bundestag. And then 2015 and 2016 happened, and you saw the party really instrumentalize discussions about migration and about the influx of refugees to become a significant political force, which they are today. When we look at their strength nationally in Germany, 2 years ago in federal elections, they won 12.6% across the country. So they are by no means the biggest party nationally, nor do I think they will become that anytime soon. But they are a significant force. They have more than 90 members of the parliament. But what we've really seen happen since 2015, 2016, is that they've become very much an Eastern German force. In all five of the former East German states, but especially Saxony, which just voted on Sunday, the party is anywhere from a quarter to a third of the vote in a lot of these Saxon cities, and you see it jumping above 20% in, I think, all of the East German states, or at least most of the East German states.
And in the town that you have just been spending some time in Görlitz, they just voted 37.8% for the populist far-right party. You stayed there for a while, and I was wondering, before we go into the politics and why it is that AfD gets so much support there, I was wondering if you could paint us a picture of the town for people who don't know anything about Görlitz. Like, was it a nice place to spend time in?
Absolutely. I will fully admit I was surprised by the extent to which I fell in love with the city a little bit. It's right on the border with Poland. It's a small to medium-sized city. It's about 57,000 people. And if you are in the historic old town, the Altstadt, it looks like the sort of picture-perfect model of an old historic German city. It's been perfectly renovated and preserved after 1990. It feels like you're in a museum. The city has existed in some form for almost 1,000 years. And so you have buildings from the Middle Ages, buildings from the Renaissance, buildings from the 18th and 19th century, and they're all sort of standing next to each other, perfectly preserved. And you really do get a sense of the history of the region. They like to note that Napoleon came not once, but twice. It feels like a life-size museum. And then you walk a couple of blocks outside of that, and you see buildings that probably at one point were as beautiful as the ones in the old city, but either are abandoned or haven't been renovated or no one lives in them. And so, you know, there's this juxtaposition between this sort of almost fairy tale, beautiful museum style city, and very, very close nearby, you have boarded up buildings. When you talk to urban planners about the city, it's, you know, some of these are in danger of literally collapsing and crumbling.
Wow, it must have been quite a strange landscape.
It is. It's the city essentially is equipped to house almost 20,000 people more than it currently has. That sort of begins to get at some of the questions of challenges that cities like Görlitz in eastern Germany are facing, populations that declined sharply after the fall of the wall when people moved west. But, you know, you see the physical remnants of that, not just one or two or three scattered around the city, but on many blocks.
It's also particularly striking, the image you painted in your article about the border between Germany and Poland, the fact that this city was at one point a bigger city. So a part of the city is now the Polish city of Zgorzelec. What are the relations like between the residents of these two adjoined borderless cities?
Well, I mean, in the day-to-day, you have people who live on one side and work on the other. In some ways, it feels fairly seamless. I mean, you can within 5 minutes walk across a bridge and be in another country with another language and another currency, and really don't even notice that in a lot of ways. On the German side, there is sort of a sense, not even just from far-right politicians, but from people across the spectrum, that the fact that Görlitz sits along the border has a lot to do with people's idea of how safe they are. The type of security concerns that we talk about, border criminality or cross-border crime, autos being stolen and taken across the border, or somebody's bike being swiped, or break-ins in apartments that are relatively near to the two bridges in town. This is something that has kind of been in the collective psyche for a long time, the idea that being near a border and having an open border means that you are more susceptible to these sorts of things. And obviously, there's one party in particular that has made this kind of their key issue, the far-right AfD. But it's something that, you know, you talk to politicians from across the spectrum, and everyone talks about this being something that makes Görlitz special. That was really my biggest question in coming there, is why does this city vote so strongly for the AfD, even more so than the state more broadly, even more so than the country more broadly? And that was one thing that in every conversation kept coming up.
Mm. I found it really interesting that you spoke to a lot of people who would talk about the kind of general immigration situation in Germany and like looking at other cities that have loads and loads of immigrants. Because the interesting thing is there's not that many refugees in Görlitz.
No.
But there seems to be this like really strong fear of this like mass arrival of people. What is that all about, do you think?
I think there's two things. And that was also one of the biggest questions I was interested in when I went there is, you know, for a place that has relatively few refugees, why is it that people there are voting so strongly for a party that is very anti-refugee? One response that I got fairly often, either from AfD politicians or from voters that I talked to, was, we see what it looks like. We read the news out of cities in West Germany. We know what it looks like in Berlin. And we don't need to have that here to know that we don't want that here. Mm. So a lot of it is rumors and things that they have heard or seen from somewhere else rather than experiences that they personally have had. And I think that's true not just in Görlitz, but across Eastern Germany, which on the whole has taken in far fewer refugees than the West. It's this idea that, you know, I've read some horror stories in the media, or, you know, my cousin lives in Cologne and told me that this happened down the street, and I don't want that to come anywhere near my everyday life. And then I think the other thing, in a city like Görlitz that is beautifully restored as it is, people, especially people who've lived there for their entire lives, especially people who didn't leave when the wall fell and stayed and dealt with the major economic and social consequences of reunification, these are people who have seen an immense amount of change in their lives, who in many cases have not financially benefited from that change, who are in many cases working two or three jobs, not being paid enough, struggling to get enough retirement to cover their costs. And on one hand, they just want things to stop changing, which I think, you know, when you've gone from a communist system into the capitalist West German system and dealt with all of the changes that come with that, is sort of an understandable belief, right? I've not benefited from change in the past, so therefore I don't want things to change in the future. I want my city to look beautiful like it does. I want it to stay the same people that I know. I want my job to stay the same. You know, that's also very much something that I heard. And then the other kind of side of that is, I've worked so hard and I still feel like I've not quite gotten what I deserve. And at least based on what I hear about what newcomers to this country are given, why is it that there's money for them? Why is it that there's support for them when I didn't have support, when I don't get the money that I need? And I'm the one who's been here my whole life and worked hard. So there's kind of threads of all of that that I heard repeatedly from people when they talked about why they felt the way that they did about refugees.
You also seem to speak to some people who were aware that voting for AfD was a bit controversial and even were conflicted about it, and some who said they wouldn't vote for the party at national level but have decided to vote for them in the regional elections. Can you explain their thinking with that decision?
I think there is a difference between local level politics and state or federal level politics, in the sense that the local level politicians are the guys that you see around town. A lot of times the kinds of proposals that they have or policies that they're talking about are not particularly partisan policies or proposals. And so the voter that you're mentioning in particular, he was more than happy to vote for the AfD candidate in a mayoral election earlier this summer. You know, for him it was, well, my neighbor is a candidate for the city council from the AfD, and I know him, and he's a good guy. And he's told me about the guy who's the mayoral candidate. And so, you know, he must also be a good guy. And the things that they're proposing on the local level are not really that different from what the other parties are proposing. And there's this sense of, I don't think that anyone in this part of the party is extreme or overly far right. I think they're just kind of normal guys. And they're saying some stuff that the other parties have long denied or don't want to admit. And then you talk to them about the national level, and they mention names of, you know, particularly far right members of the AfD and say, yeah, but I mean, I can't deal with those guys. I would never vote for those guys. But my neighbor is, he's a good guy.
Mm-hmm. So we've just had these elections in kind of the middle level, the state level, mm-hmm. and they did pretty well, the AfD. So they're now the second biggest party in both of those states, I think.
Yes.
How does that translate into actual power, though?
Well, that's the thing. At this point, it doesn't really. Unlike in Austria nearby, where the center-right party decided to take the far-right Freedom Party into government with them, in Germany, there really still is a taboo against doing that. And so at least at this point, and I think we could be having a very different conversation in 5 or 10 years, at least at this point, there's virtually no chance that the AfD is going to end up in either of these governments. For them, some of the things that you heard from national level AfD politicians on election night, I think, give a clue as to why this is still a big victory for them. Alice Weidel, she's one of the co-leaders of the party. She said, this means we are a people's party, you know, the term for sort of a big centrist, big tent kind of party. And they've really used the results from Brandenburg and Saxony to say, okay, look, see, this is proof that we are part of the mainstream. This is proof that we need to be taken seriously and that other parties need to stop treating us like complete outsiders. And so, you know, for them, sure, would they have in theory liked to be the largest party and liked to have the option to attempt to build a government in each of these states? Absolutely. But I think for the AfD, essentially, their entire 6 years of existence at this point, they have been fighting to be taken seriously, and they've been fighting to be treated like part of the political mainstream. And if you judge Sunday's results by that measure, I think that they have taken another step in that direction.
We have a weekly podcast about Europe, and as everyone knows, there's been like quite a surge in far-right politicians across the whole of the continent recently. And we are constantly grappling with thoughts of how best to talk about this. We don't want to ignore them, but some argue, including one of our previous guests, a populism expert called Timo Lochocki, he tried to convince us not to talk about the far-right so much. He was saying that we are giving them too much oxygen and it makes them more and more important. Did you grapple with this dilemma in your reporting?
Absolutely. It's something that, and you know, having covered this for a couple of years now, it's something that I always think about. You know, on the one hand, I do recognize that by drawing attention to these parties, you are helping to, well, draw attention to these parties. The more that we write about them, the more they and the issues that they talk about are in the political mainstream, in the headlines, and in people's consciousness. On the other hand, I think that at least in Germany and in particularly in East Germany, the AfD has reached a point where it's impossible to ignore them. And one of my goals, to the extent possible, and that was a big part of wanting to go and spend an entire month in Görlitz rather than just showing up for a couple of days, was I think that it's also important to sometimes take a step back from the way we write about these things nationally and try to talk to as many people as we can to understand why people support the party, why, what their frustrations are, what is leading them to the point that they cast that ballot. So I don't know. I mean, I think there's a couple of things we can do. One of them is to try and get at the reasons behind people's votes. The other thing I think that I try to be very careful of and would encourage other journalists to do is to try and think about the terminology we use when we write about them. You know, writing, for example, about the refugee crisis or talking about the, you know, old parties, established parties, et cetera, trying to be careful not to use necessarily the exact framing or terms that far-right parties use. I think sometimes you know, the more we do that, the more it makes the arguments that they make and the things that they say, things that we would say without thinking about it. And so, you know, I always try to be cautious about the way that I phrase something or the words that I use when I'm talking about one of these parties.
I would really like somebody to write me like a kind of vocab list for how to talk about this stuff.
Yeah, me too.
Can you do that for us? Thank you, Emily. I feel more anxious and unsure than ever exactly how we should talk about the far right, Dominic, and whether we should talk about it at all.
Actually, I think she speaks about it really well. So I recommend you read her article if you're interested. Actually, she wrote two articles about Gurlitz. She was there for a month. One which is on the ICWA website and another that was in The Atlantic. We'll post both of them in our show notes and also follow her on Twitter because she's a really interesting person writing in English about that area.
At Emily RS.
Who wants to be a millionaire? Well,
me.
A German lot. You're meant to say I do. That's how the song goes. Do you not know the song?
Sorry.
Well, you're not the only one that wants to be a millionaire. There's a German lawyer named Jan Stroh who did. In fact, he wanted to be a millionaire so much. Oh, actually, he wanted to be on the show Who Wants to Be a Millionaire so much that he created a kind of basic replica of the studio in his basement in Hamburg so that he could host quiz nights with his friends and pretend he was on the show. Sometimes he would be the host, sometimes he'd be a contestant, but he had a replica chair, some fake palm trees, all the sound effects, and most importantly, he had the capacity for glitter explosions if required.
Oh my God. God, the hoovering must have been a nightmare.
Yeah, that's so true. I hadn't thought about that.
Also, were there palm trees on the German version?
As I said that, I was like, did I make that up?
No, I read that too, but I'm just like, why?
Yeah, I don't think they existed on the British version.
It's less exotic.
It still airs in France, doesn't it?
I think so, yeah. It's super popular everywhere. People love this show.
Yeah, and actually it seems to be having revivals. So it stopped in the UK in 2014, but it's back again. It seems to have quite an enduring appeal. I mean, it certainly does for Jan, who watched all of the 1,407 episodes before his own, and he'd seen 2,800 contestants take their place in the famed chair. Less than a dozen people have actually won the top prize in the show's history in Germany. And he had applied himself to be on the show many times. And finally, for the 20th anniversary episode, the showrunners decided to reward his dedication and give him a slot. In what might be the nicest happy ending ever, Jan's practice paid off and he went on to win the €1 million.
Yay!
So Jan, he's very happy. He's not going to give up his job as a city lawyer. So he doesn't really need the money to survive, but he does want to get a new suit. He wants to do some traveling. He wants to give some of it to charity.
Aww.
And he thinks maybe it's time to revamp his Who Wants to Be a Millionaire set in his basement.
Bigger palm trees.
Yeah. Now, there is one footnote to this story, which some of the articles I read didn't mention. I had to go into the German articles with Google Translate to find this out.
Ooh, you went deep.
I know, yeah. All the questions he asked were questions that have been on the show at some point during the show's history. So, of course he won.
So they just recycle the questions?
Yeah, they were all questions that had been used at some point before. And this guy is so obsessed with the show that he used to miss, and maybe still does, family gatherings to make sure he could watch all the episodes, which I should point out, it used to run 3 nights a week, now only twice. So I think actually it's a bit patronizing and they should have given him a real ride on the game show. It's a sham, I tell you. That's all we've got time for today. Hasn't it whizzed by?
It has.
Just like our holidays.
Feels good to be back. We have got lots of new people to thank who have generously signed up to support us on Patreon while we were away. Are you ready?
Yeah, go on.
Sarah Ampolsk, William Panham, Amanda Chu, Felix Trench, Arusa Hakayan, Liddy Schreiter, and Monica Eleanor. And I'm pretty sure I just masked about half of your name, so please accept my sincere apologies if I did. And let me know what I should have said. Our Patreon club is growing and growing. By the time you hear this, I will also have started sending out our very beautiful tote bags to some of the most generous of our generous supporters. The old logo lives on in the form of these very wonderful fair trade bags, which are emblazoned with the furious face of Emmanuel Macron. They're going down a treat.
And that brings us to the fact that we've got a new logo, which we haven't talked about yet, Katie. We've got a whole new rebrand, in fact.
It's possible that no one's actually listening to this because they haven't realised that we are that podcast that used to have the Angry Macron logo.
That could well happen. It's now got us two on it, which may be a big mistake, but we've been convinced that it's what we should do. So sorry, you're going to have to put up with our faces.
I like our faces. I like yours anyway.
Well, you are nice.
I tell you, it won't last.
But go and check out our new website. We've got a new website which has been designed by Mariah Martins from Are We Europe, and we're incredibly grateful to her for all the work she's done on it. It looks beautiful, we think. So we hope you do too. And a big thank you to Philippe Constantinescu, who designed our new logo.
It's very snazzy.
Before we go, I want to give a quick shout out to anyone who is in Amsterdam this week, because our wonderful new producer slash brilliant radio person, Katz Laszlo, who's actually a new member of the team, who we should tell you all about, and you will eventually hear her voice.
Well, at some we might. Point. She's very reluctant to actually sit in front of a microphone, but we'll make it happen.
We are going to make it happen. Anyway, Kat is running a really beautiful sounding event in Amsterdam, which I, for one, am definitely attending. It's called Cineradio, and it's a pretty unique collective listening experience in a cinema. We're all going to be sitting in a dark cinema, listening to beautiful stories from around the world that are not in English but have projected subtitles. I think it's marvelous and I can't wait. And Katz is going to be hosting it and guiding us through these stories. It's on the 12th of September at Criterion in Amsterdam. I'll post a link to the event in the show notes.
We'll be back next week with more tales of this European life. In the meantime, you can find us as always on a wealth of social media websites. Twitter at EuropeansPod, Instagram at EuropeansPodcast, and facebook.com/TheEuropeansPodcast.
Maybe we should do a Luciana Lamorghese and like go off all the socials.
It would be better for all of us. But we've got a brand to build now, Dominic. We've got the super swanky website and everything.
Okay.
See you on the internet then.
See you on the internet. Bye.
Bye.